Yep. All right. So we'll go ahead and get started with part two, which begins by applying what's going on with critical. So again, we're doing some kind of history stuff in philosophy. We're meeting some characters. We're teasing out a few themes. But the main thought is, where do these ideas come from? How do they get packaged and sugar-coated into a pill, as it were, be transferable, that all different kinds of people can take them up in different ways, even without knowing some of this stuff? And that way it gives us a better understanding. So critical theories more will bring us quite close, frankly, to the present day. And then we're going to kick it back again and go to the past a little bit with Marxisms, starting with Marx and coming forward from there, because Marxist has become a very contested term, right? And we went for a good long while in the last decade without seeing the word Marxism or Marxist in our newspapers, and then boom, there it is, all of a sudden here in the last year or so. So critical theories. We've got critical philosophy, which any philosophy that affirms, remember it, when the mind constitutes in whole or in part the thing known, kind of like you have, you know, baking powder, baking soda, whatever, and the ingredients here where it actually will cause some of the wet ingredients to stand and to take shape and to stand forth in that way. The mind is doing the same thing, according to critical philosophy, to make the world intelligible, so we don't necessarily know what the world really is. But if we believe that we all have the same categories, hey, we're knowing it in the same way. So science works. But as I mentioned, the further step in the process is, what if men and women have different categories? What if English Australians and Aborigines have different categories? What if rich and poor have different categories? And so on and so forth. So critical theories build on this fundamental insight of critical philosophy as the starting point for all thought, even as a moral requirement for the philosopher. In other words, you have to pursue and understand all of these categories that are being brought to philosophy and that other people don't have them, and to figure out what all the other ones are as well and how in that way the world is shaped for them. So they take that more maximal approach we were talking about, that all the categories, the key categories at least, in this way are shaped that way. The social construction of categories is a kind of knowledge creation. If you understand that line, you'll understand a lot more going on in the world today. The social construction of categories. So we're seeing this happen in real time, right? Have any of you come across one of the published lists of various sexual orientations? And they have lengthened. I came across one recently in study, over 100 entries. Pansexual, dissexual, all these different kinds of things, far beyond the LG and then the LGBT and then the LGBTQIA and so forth. In this way, actually, as all of these words are used, and then as they are approved, and as more and more conversation continues in that way, we're seeing people socially construct categories. So interestingly, nowadays, someone couldn't come up to you right off the bat and simply say, hey, it's good to meet you, I'm a pansexual. And you know exactly what they're talking about. But they would actually if they said, hey, I'm a transgendered individual. Like, actually, everyone would kind of understand that category in a way. Because at this point now, that category has been socially constructed deeply enough that pretty much everyone, at least in our society, has a basic working knowledge of what that means and so forth. Interestingly, this is a bit to the side, but I was doing metaphysics, right? Ultimate reality, right? And the ultimate reality of our humanity. I was doing it with undergraduates one time. And so in a kind of application point, I asked them if they knew, we connected with the transgender issue here, but I asked them, do you know the word transvestite? None of them did. This was 2 years ago, and so it'd be a room of 18-year-olds undergraduates. And it was just fascinating to me. I was like, I am 10 years older than you are, right? And it's simply because of the synthesis of testosterone and estrogen. We've seen a very quick differentiation now between simply being able to dress as the opposite gender and actually able to inject synthetic estrogen, synthetic testosterone, and be able to do different alterations that make the person in that way feel more like they have successfully crossed from one sex to the other. There is a certain social construction in that way of a category. We can kind of understand at least that in part. But again, it's a wildly different claim to say all categories are socially constructed. And if you end up there, then simply speaking is part of the social construction of categories. And if that category advances my cause, you're my ally. If that category harms my cause, you're my enemy. You've victimized me in some sense. This is how speech can become allyship or violence, as you see these days. Critical theorists understand knowledge to be a construction whose patterns and policing favor the powerful. In fact, we could say that patterning and policing what counts as knowledge just is what makes a group powerful or not powerful. It's where some of the critical theories do go. So they would say, what I do as a teacher, for example, when I teach grammar, that is simply an expression of power, right? That the grammar is not right or wrong, nor my teaching maybe of symbolism in a piece of literature, or how the scanning of Latin poetry, because that's, you know, that's where I'm evolved there too, or these different, that it's actually simply a construction that we call knowledge. In some sense, it's not even anymore aiming at the target of truth or falsehood. It's simply aiming at the target of power. And some people get to pattern and police what counts as knowledge, and those are the powerful people. And so, at this point, if you want to overthrow that or overcome that, all you can do is get representation of different people with different categories that represent particular groups, right, to try to represent something in this way into existence. Because we don't have the same categories, we are constantly creating knowledge, so the only thing we can do is get that knowledge creation coming out of the right spigots, right? The right hoses from people with these different categories. Therefore, knowledge is political. Like, hopefully that brings through your mind what often came into you through your gut, right? You probably at some point in the last 5 years have come into that feeling like, whoa, what is happening? Like, we're talking about ideas. We're reading books. This is not some political kind of thing we're doing. I'm not harming this person. This person's not harming me. And you felt maybe disjointed? Well, that is sort of the intellectual pattern, the pattern of thoughts that leads to the conclusion knowledge is political. That it doesn't simply understand and discover true things, but create the social relationships, the political laws, and even the meaning of justice in a society. Critical theories spring from identity, because only certain identity groups can contain certain truths or kinds of knowledge. Only within those groups can certain truths or kinds of knowledge be discovered. So the idea here then would be that certain kinds of truths can only be discovered from within, say, the group of women. Where the group of men, the nasty patriarchy, where it is putting forward various kinds of concepts, and men are doing all the talking, they're socially constructing reality in such a way that the natural kinds of concepts that the whole group of women would bring are sort of invalidated from the very beginning. So the only thing you can do is overthrow all the systems that allow men to do all the talking and participate in the social construction of reality. Now, of course, men and women, I mean, we're about 50-50. Here on the face of the planet, and we always kind of will be, unless the Lord really changes his plan somehow, which is fascinating. I shouldn't get off on that. But it's interesting. Right after war, right, you lose tons of men, and it's always fascinating how quickly that equilibrium comes back, even in some of the world's greatest cataclysms, like the Civil War in this country and so forth. And yeah, we're coming back. We're getting back on track here. What if, though, you're dealing with categories that are BIPOC, as we have nowadays, black, indigenous, people of color. What if you're dealing with all the racial categories? What if you're dealing with every category of socioeconomic class? What if you're dealing with categories that have to do with different life experiences? Like, now you're really getting into a conflicting kind of way of who are we actually trying to have represent different kinds of positions. So the term developed for this here is standpoint epistemology. Epistemology, fancy word, is the traditional word to refer to the theory of knowledge. So what can we know? How can we know it? Those kinds of questions. And this standpoint epistemology essentially teaches that the position where you stand in terms of your family, your history, your body, your birthplace, your heritage determines what it is you can know and how you can know it. So let's consider, for example, here Senator Tammy Duckworth. She is a Democratic senator from the state of Illinois. Recently, upon her election and taking seat in the Senate, there was actually a good bit of discussion that reflected on standpoint epistemology. Because she was a mother, she served in the military, even took serious injury. And so you may have noticed that even some of these conversations have the binary between the able-bodied and the disabled in some way. And if you privilege the able-bodied, that's known as ableism, right? So she had a mother nursing a woman and not fully able-bodied, and talked about herself as now finally bringing into representation into the Senate someone who had all of those, you could say, background credentials or that particular standpoint. And it was presented in such a way that she was now able to do things no one else could do. She was able to think things no one else could think. She was able to represent in ways no one else could represent. The problem is that completely removes the purpose of the Senate, which is to debate and to discuss laws. Because the whole point is that she should be able to speak to her partner senator from the state of Illinois and describe what it is that she wants to put into law. And do the same thing with the senators from Nebraska, or coordinate with the House so that the House maybe could pass it. The whole point is that you're supposed to be able to speak, describe, talk, win, persuade, all those kinds of things. And if this actually runs all the way through, she can only speak, describe, persuade people who already are nursing mothers, women not fully able-bodied. Like, do you see what's going on there? So it's one thing if a person simply says, hey, you have a particular background and a wonderful insight, right? It's very true that if you put the blueprints for the new church in front of the nursing mothers, they will have a good standpoint from which to say, you know, we want to make sure that, you know, we've got, you know, proper lighting in this area, that there are good ways to incorporate the nursing mothers into the worship of the church. Absolutely, right? People are going to have different insights because of that standpoint. But this view is actually saying that your knowledge is constituted by your standpoint. Because even in my little illustration about the blueprint and having different people with different backgrounds look at the blueprint, the point actually is that we look up from the blueprint then and we talk to each other. And we say, from my standpoint, I know that this kind of a room would be important. We need to run some electronics there, so there's a television in this space, or you can hear it well, or maybe double-sided glass, or like the whole point is that we can then talk about it, share that standpoint. So in this, persons of different races and origins simply can and cannot do certain things, or can and cannot know certain things according to this particular view. You see how this, like, it removes the normal truth-aimed model of the human mind. And it replaces it with a political aim. Like, your mind's ability to know things on this view is no longer aimed at truth. It's aimed at politics. It's aimed at organizing yourself with others in public. And getting yourself your team, or excluding the other team, or whatever it might be. Simply advancing and removing causes, not actually just gaining in knowledge. So knowledge is not aimed at truth gathering, but aimed at political organization. So critical theory includes the development and interrogation of ideas from these particular standpoints and identity groups. You've got feminist theory, queer theory, fat studies, handicap studies, post-colonial theory, and on and on it goes. I mean, in some sense, you can truly say on and on it goes from just about every standpoint you could describe. And each of these is just a quick sampling of even things I've read. There are academic journals devoted to each one of these areas of study and many more. So you can read the Journal of Fat Studies, for example, if you have a little extra time on your hands later. You know, if you want to, you could read the Journal of Ableist Studies. So, questions on critical theory before we do Marx. Can you see a little bit the progress of this idea of critical philosophy then in the categories with which a person comprehends the world and what the world actually is, all the way then eventually to some of these kind of issues we've seen in our present day? Sure, yeah. Right. Because you end up, what folks end up wanting is representation, sort of a political representation, and a way to say, you've got to get me and my group in there. And so it does incentivize us to focus on differences rather than God-given sameness, like you say there, rather than our connection with one another, our common human nature. And it's interesting how the snake eventually always makes it around and starts eating its... Because even, for example, the Journal of Fat Studies, you know, was attacked for othering thin people, right? Folks who maybe even were excessively thin or struggled to keep on some weight or things like that. And it just, it in that way, it ends up just going into complete chaos, you might say, almost a kind of nothingness. Sure. Right, right. So it's a good point. I didn't get into intersectionality as much because we're driving towards critical race theory and its unique effect this way, but it's a perfect point to touch on that, right? Intersectionality simply is a view derived from critical theory that says essentially your intersecting identities determine your political position and power. And so we must overthrow those systems that give this kind of privilege and power to certain intersecting identities, which in our country basically is always, well, I guess in one way, even worldwide, is always male, white, cisgendered, heteronormative, that kind of thing. Because it's interesting, no one actually looks at, you know, other places on earth and divides it up in just about any other way. It's pretty much that way. And that someone with those intersecting identities, if many of them intersect and they're all less privileged, that person would require a more energetic exception, you might say, to put them forward for the sake of representation. It's even more important that that person receive a kind of privileged place to speak and create that social construction of category that gives them some power in that way. This is the way the thought goes, yeah. And again, the sad reality is every time that happens, it's like another nail in the coffin of our connection to one another. Because if that person then connects, and there's a greater deepening of our unified front as human beings, well, then that person no longer has power, the new power in this new theory, the power that put them forward requiring a particular kind of representation, not on the basis of any other factor, but on the basis of the factor that they had intersecting identities that made them not powerful. And so not being powerful became a kind of power. Which is why some people will use silly phrases like the intersectional Olympics or something. And they're kind of onto something because it becomes in some way almost a competition to be able to make sure that you've got some of those intersecting ideas that take away power from you, because then you've actually got some power. Right, right. Yeah, and so because you're going to have to find the most oppressed person to forward their voice on this view. Otherwise, you're simply populating the world with the categories of the powerful and reinforcing their power. Sure, yeah. We can pause real quick there and notice that that is really circular. Because then again, when we put forward critical theory, isn't that just a view of the powerful that's reinforcing their power, and on it goes. So we've got Marxism, okay, a word now commonly used in these last several years. Again, especially if you've been around the block a time or two, whether it has to do with books and library research and you've loved the life of the mind, or actually if it's just life, right? I mean, if you went back to the 70s, right, in the United States, in public, in newspapers, talk about Marxism a lot. Especially communism, Soviet style, as we'll see. But for a while, it certainly went away and became more of just an intellectual concept or idea. Now it's sort of practical once again and showing up in school board meetings and all the rest. So let's take a look at these different Marxisms. So Karl Marx there is dates 1818 to 1883. He was, so about 200 years ago. The reigning philosophy of his time was known as dialectical idealism, okay, which sounds very fancy. The basic idea behind idealism is that what is ultimately real is ideas. So the main teacher of this idea, powerful in his influence in Germany, was Georg Hegel, and he would have absolute spirit, capital A, capital S, basically we could say. I mean, he didn't say absolute spirit because he spoke in German. It would have been Geist, but the idea was, it's capitalized. It's God, in some sense. Now, he was very pantheistic in that way, was God, or that this idea, this realm of ideas was God. Not all the material things are God, not at all. But riding astride, you could say, developing through all of history is this absolute spirit. And that's where the dialectic thing comes in. You can kind of feel dialogue a little bit there, this back and forth idea. Normally we think about, like, two competing statements, and we're like, oh, which one's right and which one's wrong? Instead, Hegel sets up a basic logic where they synthesize, right, this thesis and this antithesis synthesize into a higher thesis that gets awfully difficult to penetrate. I could explain it for about an hour, but then also I would say, yeah, at some point Hegel just kind of goes into oblivion here. I don't think his view of logic ultimately works. But ultimately, the basic idea takes hold that the process of history itself is sort of advancing to new heights of ideas, which is absolute spirit, which is in some sense God. Now, Marx rejects dialectical idealism for dialectical materialism. And this is where it's helpful. Because he still believes in these processes of history that is going somewhere and it's naturally producing these kinds of outcomes, but it's not idea that is going back and forth in this way, that's driving the process. It's material. Material goods, material things. Raw resources, even capital, right? As that, for the first time in history, we're having industrial level capital, significant tools and factories and things like this being produced at a different level than ever found before. So this progress of history and material things produces, Marx says, two classes. Like, it's actually three, you could say, but he only identifies two. More on that in a moment. We got the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. Okay, you'll notice the French terms there. He's primarily, even in terms of France and Paris, that this would be the place where his theory would take hold. Also places like London and Brussels and stuff in Western Europe. So the bourgeoisie is the middle class, the emerging middle class, that is benefiting from the Industrial Revolution and the rise of capital goods and some of the comforts it has provided. At this point, we're seeing even in this class an increase in health or leisure or available time for other pursuits due to the fact, for example, that now factories are making shirts, right? Instead of having each individual, most often, you know, wife and mother in a household, maybe make them for the whole family or something like that. So the bourgeoisie is actually more of the genuine development. The rich have always been there, but for some reason Marx never talks about the rich. Well, to this day, it's something that we all still love to point out or debate or go back and forth. Why does Marx not talk about the super rich? Right? Even if you look at the Bible, right, Jesus said, you know, the poor you'll always have with you. And we've basically, in every society, always had the super rich and the super poor. The middle class is what historically has been rare and needs explanation. So the bourgeoisie needs explanation. The proletariat, in this sense, is not a new development. It is new, and he's identifying something different in the sense that life for the lower classes or the workers is a lot different. You're right. You're no longer maybe in a setting on your own land, raising your own crops and family, all as one kind of massive work. You're moved off maybe to a city. You're away for many, many hours of the day at the factory. Not even the 8 that we would say, right? 10, 11, 12, even 14 hours a day sometimes. And so in that way, there is a different sort of in what the proletariat is experiencing. Okay, so the progress of history, the back and forth, this dialectic, material goods, raw things, capital, and all this, it's produced what he sees in these two classes. He has an eschatology, Marx does, a doctrine of last things, you could say, that a utopia or a perfect political vision would arrive when the proletariat became aware of themselves as a class and engaged in the Marxist revolution against the bourgeoisie. So when the proletariat can finally become conscious of what it actually is, it will be able to overthrow the bourgeoisie, because there's more of them than us, right? It's kind of like, you know, what if the kids all figured it out? There's more of them than us, you know, when we're teachers or something. Or Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds, if you've ever seen it, right? What if the birds figured it out and they started attacking us, you know? Like, when the proletariat becomes conscious of themselves as a class, they can overthrow the bourgeoisie, which, again, is so hilarious. What do you mean overthrow the bourgeoisie? The bourgeoisie is the middle class. Bourgeoisie is not the owners. Don't you overthrow the owners? But that's another point for another day. The proletariat, through this class consciousness, a real key term there in Marxism, could understand its central role in the production of industrial life and overthrow the bourgeoisie. Marx thought this would apply, as I said, in London, Paris, Brussels, Munich. He thinks only of Western Europe. That's his context. That's where he's from. Because they had highly developed capitalist societies with large amounts of domestic product and growing middle classes. Marx never conceived of his theories applying in places like Russia, which still had only two classes, the aristocracy and the serfs. Marxism utterly fails, even ingloriously. So I've got written there the slaughter of the communards in 1871. If you want to look at that, it's a pretty well-developed area of history in the sense that you could easily buy some good popular history books from Amazon. You'd find plenty of decent information about it quickly, although it's not as well-known of an area of history in the sense that many of us don't have much of a working knowledge of it. You know, it's like we don't have a walking-around knowledge of this, and yet it's pretty well-trod trails. You know, if you go out and you want to find different books and things on the matter. Essentially, this is the Second Franco-Prussian War, right? So it's Prussia because still Germany is not unified. But German speakers, the largest German kingdom is the Kingdom of Prussia. And so the French have been at war. This is the Third Republic. You remember we've had one republic since 1787, right? When our constitution takes hold. They have their revolution in 1789. They're on their fifth right now. So the poor French, right? We're definitely beating them as far as our first. I should be a little more kind, I don't know. But the Third Republic of France at this point wastes a great deal of money, resource, and the blood of men in this particular war against Prussia, which they were not well fit for at that point. At the same time, Marx's ideas had took hold, and the communards then literally created a commune in Paris. They were against war, they were anti-government, they were against the Third Republic of France. Eventually, the Third Republic would slaughter them, even sometimes just creating firing lines. And so even now, if you go to Paris, you will find several memorials and a very large cemetery dedicated to them for, frankly, a proper mourning for an unbelievably overreaching kind of government and an act of evil in that way. So it's interesting how history turns, because I don't agree with the communards at all in their particular political philosophy. And yet, anyone who's martyred in that way still has a certain kind of dignity, right? And even to this day, the communards inspire communists worldwide. So it's the fall of a short-lived revolution in Western Europe there in the lifetime of Marx, whose name I have a typo there. In the work of the communards, though, then begins the central question that now wanders about in Marxist European experience for 100 years like a ghost wandering a graveyard. Why did the Marxist revolution fail? And fail among precisely the people who should have received its revolution. After the experience of the communards, all the Marxists are going, see, we get killed. We did get slaughtered by the government, but part of that was because we couldn't get these people to agree with us. We couldn't get the proletariat to rise up. We couldn't get the workers actually to want what we were offering. They wanted what capitalism offers. They wanted what the government offers. They wanted this machine of war against the Prussians and all these things that the government can do and so forth. Well, why do they want this? That becomes the sort of ghost wandering the graveyard for all the rest, frankly, right up to our own day, in different forms of Marxism. Why did the revolution fail precisely when it should have succeeded? It's interesting how that could be a good reason for someone to abandon the view. Maybe Marxism just isn't right. But very often people end up then doubling down, right? Why am I still right? I know I'm still right. I just haven't found out why yet. So, the early answers are then because that the revolution failed because of comfort, essentially. Capitalism simply made life easier with its tools and technologies, its brand names. It won the argument before the argument even got started. Leninism, and you see Lenin's dates there, 1870 to 1924, so it's just about 100 years from his death. You can still go see him in his tomb because he's basically worshipped in Red Square in Russia. Glass covering on his tomb there still, if you are so brave. Takes the fundamental ideas of Marxism and applies it in a different shape. And because of the long Cold War here in the U.S., we tend to think of Marxism in connection with Soviet-style communism. So we'll see a little difference here. Leninism argues for the seizing and controlling of the means of production with the government. So the government would control various natural resources, maybe have a controlling interest in the companies that harvest them, or maybe even just totally control it as an entire government enterprise. Lenin leads the Bolsheviks against the Mensheviks. So, again, an area that you could easily find resources and books and things on, even though some of us don't remember the fall of the Tsars, and then there's a provisional government. In fact, the Germans at this point in World War I are at war with Russia, and they think to themselves, hey, we're going to weaken this provisional government if we let this guy Lenin make it to Russia, because he'll probably overthrow the government. And it'll take him an awfully long time to build up a new army and actually to be able to continue to confront us in the war, and it'll be to our advantage. So the Germans actually let Lenin through back to Russia, and he overthrows the provisional government in the Bolshevik Revolution in that time, and an embedded Soviet-style communism in Russia. But notice, it's not Marxism, technically. There's no bourgeoisie. There's no proletariat in the traditional sense. This is not a capitalist society, Russia. Russia is still based on serfdom at this point. It will become then an industrial society under Lenin, and then particularly Stalin after him. Stalin was many things and incredibly evil, but one thing we can actually say is that he was the figure who transformed Russian society into an industrial sort of powerhouse as well at that point. So this is not Marxism in the traditional sense. It's an adaptation of some central ideas of Marxism into communism and into a soil that Marx would not have recognized. Other communist revolutions have been tried. Communists, they're remarkably, like, admirably even connected to one another. You know, the only thing more connected across the entire world is the Church of the Lord Jesus Christ. It is pretty remarkable. Worldwide, all these different communist parties are always communicating with each other and connected to each other in that way. But one of those failures is in the face of fascism. So we easily forget one of the reasons that some of the Germans voted for the Nazis is because one of the alternatives was the communists. And sometimes where communists were supported in Central Europe at that point is because the alternative was some kind of a fascist government. No one hated the communists as much as the fascists. No one hated the fascists as much as the communists. They were certainly enemies that deserved each other. And in that way, it's just an entirely sad state of affairs. People have sometimes called this the horseshoe theory of politics. Just like the shape of a horseshoe, the further you get out, the closer you actually end up getting to each other. And in this way, Nazis and communists are very different, but they're also very much the same in the totalitarianism that's involved, the total claim of the government on every area of life. So this does bring us now to the fellow you see at the bottom of page 9, dear Antonio Gramsci. I mean, he looks all nice there, buttoned up with his glasses and everything, but he is a communist imprisoned by the fascist Benito Mussolini in Italy, right? You remember Benito Mussolini? He is the fascist that will join up in Central Europe with Adolf Hitler to create the Axis powers. And so he, a fascist, imprisons the communist agitator Gramsci. Gramsci, you'll see his dates, 1891 to 1937. He's the most central figure in the development of cultural Marxism because Marxism, overall, he's continuing this tradition of asking the question, why have we failed? Looking back to the communards, coming through all of World War I and entering into World War II, he doesn't live to see ultimately the end of World War II, but why has communism failed? So Gramsci answers the question about Marxism's failure in this way. It's on page 10 in italics, and I think this probably just deserves to be read. It's as if he's saying this. Marxism has failed because of the materialism. It is not simply that the dialectics, this back and forth of material goods, the means of production and natural resources, determine the fate of man and the classes. Culture is one of those things that is produced. So Marx and Lenin think about the engines of production. And when they think about the engines of production, it's stuff. Iron ore, you know, gold, wheat. The kind of things that you win in your game, the Settlers of Catan, right? You know? But one thing the Settlers of Catan does not have is music, science, categories like we talked about earlier, social ideas. And Gramsci's saying, the problem is, it's all these social ideas, they're part of it. The trading back and forth of all these concepts. Now, he's not totally wrong to recognize how cultural production works. Like everything that comes out of Hollywood, including the Oscars and the ritual of walking the red carpet, it's a cultural production. The phones in our hand, it's cultural production. Or a codex, which is a book with a spine, it's a cultural production. And even a child who can't read it picks it up and goes, there's something important about this, and begins this kind of seedling expectation that I should participate in this stuff someday, right? It's even said that children, like, this is an actual data from study, but interestingly enough, children who grow up in homes where there are at least 100 books in the house end up reading faster and better than those who aren't. Probably just due to the expectation that stuff's important up there. Power tools in my toolbox, conveniences like dishwashers and refrigerators in our homes, they're all cultural productions. They precondition us to favor certain things, right? I don't know about you, but I am a little bit preconditioned to favor whatever system gives me air conditioning. A little bit. Kind of, okay. Gramsci articulates the fundamental insight, about which he's not completely wrong, that people would prejudge in favor of capitalism rather than Marxism because capitalism gave them refrigerators and gave them clothes washers. Further, capitalism, here's a real key, gives us newspapers, radio, and eventually TV. Each of these engines of cultural production creates a constant conversation in the political community. Discourses. Discourses now take it as a technical term. It's a special term now being used to describe the constant conversation that determines what a particular political community, so a community of common action, you could say, whether it's all Americans or whether it's that the way that community has proliferated, like people refer to the LGBTQ community as if they're like a meeting every week or something, or the community of audio-visual, you know, technicians, or the community of this, the community of Latin teachers. I've not been a part of the community of Latin teachers yet. Like, I've never been to the meeting. I don't carry a card for it. But anyone could easily say the community of Latin teachers, right? the Latin community believes this or believes that. The Latin community is sorry for excluding these people or those. Where is the Latin community? Where does it exist? Who knows, right? If anything, it's bound together by this Gramscian idea of discourses. It's not just Gramscian idea, but he certainly is one of the earliest figures to bring forward this idea that that is part of our cultural production. Not only the technology like a refrigerator, but also our discourses and way of speaking is a cultural production that, again, for him, is disincentivizing people right off the bat from the Marxist revolution. That's why the proletariat haven't taken hold of these things. It's the discourses, the constant conversation in the political community. So, in this way, conversation shapes the way you view the world, even unbeknownst to you. And Gramsci represents the turn towards cultural Marxism. And cultural Marxism probably should have been bold-faced type there. That is probably one of the words you've come into contact with, maybe even in the newspapers or some of the very public conversation in our country that makes us want to do this morning, cultural Marxism. Using Marxist ideas and moving away simply from natural materials and raw goods into the cultural sphere. So cultural Marxism basically believes this. Not only the material productions of culture, but also the linguistic and language-based productions of culture shape political classes whose class consciousness is now cultural consciousness and whose hope is now cultural revolution. We don't need a class revolution with regard to capital. We don't need somehow all of the drivers of the Amazon trucks to organize and revolutionize against Bezos and take over the whole building and now kind of, in some sense, organize in that way with all of Amazon. Although, of course, people still argue for that type of thing. And that's in the news too, the fact that Amazon is not participating in organized labor work. But the main driver in cultural Marxism is that we are oppressed not by capital, but by culture. And actually that overcoming this is now a class consciousness, not saying we're the proletariat, we're the laborers who make all the capital work. It's saying we are those who have been excluded by the discourses of those more powerful. And it has shaped how everyone sees the world, and we've not been included in that. A communist student in the 60s, Rudy Dutschke, gave us this phrase, the long march through the institutions. And so coming out of Gramsci, and this particular turn in cultural Marxism, a new expectation arises that in all the institutions, the schools, even the religious institutions, the businesses, especially the larger ones, we can create a set of expectations that will create a new class consciousness, which is a cultural consciousness. And people will understand when they are the ones who were excluded from the kind of discourse that gave other people power and kept them in power. And so in a longer time frame, we won't just simply call all the proletariat to us at once and have a revolution, but in a long time frame, we'll make people conscious of this. You'll even begin to start to see there the metaphors about sleeping or waking, being unconscious or conscious. And this is ultimately where a term woke will describe some of these features. So we need another concept real quick before we leave Gramsci, because Gramsci is the one who kind of kicks off this idea of hegemony, cultural hegemony, H-E-G-E-M-O-N-Y, hegemony. So hegemony refers to one's power, influence, or control in a situation, usually a political, military, or economic one. So Apple has a kind of hegemony in the technological world. Even if someone is wanting ultimately to develop their own technology, product line, in some sense, they still have to take Apple into account. Or anyone who's going to produce Bluetooth earpieces or something, they're all like, well, let's make sure it works pretty well with the Apple products because there are a ton of them out there. That's hegemony. Even their competitors have to take into account some of the technology they develop, some of the electronics they employ, and the products they're rolling out. The U.S. has a kind of hegemony internationally with regard to economics. China's been growing with its own kind of hegemony in its area. Hegemony creates spheres of influence. When you have hegemony, what seems normal for you is assumed as normal for everyone. When you have hegemony, what seems normal for you is assumed as normal for everyone. Now again, let's watch this closely. The same thing happens here as what happened with critical philosophy. It's one thing if you're simply saying, you know, this might affect whether a person wears a business suit or a turban. It might affect whether you use chopsticks or silverware, right? It's quite another if you're claiming that the only reason people think about men and women in a certain way, or marriage, or education, or human nature, that is simply based on someone's hegemony. It's like when the British had their empire in the subcontinent of India, British ways seemed normal for all people. American cultural phenomena can seem normal, because business has to be done with the American dollar and with Americans. So you have clothing made on the other side of the world that's made to the specifications of, say, the height of an average American male, not the height of an average Indian or Chinese male. Cultural hegemony, then, extends political, economic, or military hegemony into the cultural sphere, and it says the same thing that happens with economics, the same thing that happens with the military, happens with culture. You simply receive or believe certain cultural things because someone else's hegemony has extended over you, and what feels normal to them is expressed as if it's a norm of all human nature when it's just them. It's just the ones with hegemony. So, do you see, like, it connects with critical philosophy and critical theory because it's saying, essentially, if mind constitutes in whole or in part the object known, since the ways of knowing those who have hegemony are the most powerful, we assume that what's normal for them is just true and normal for everyone. And so you may have come across this term, heteronormativity. This is where someone is simply saying, all throughout our history here, these heterosexual persons who've been marrying each other and having families and all these things, all their assumptions have simply been extended over all of humanity as if they're normal, as if they're part of nature. They have created the norms, but they're just norms. They're expressed as part of nature, but they're not part of nature. They're part of heteronormativity, a kind of cultural hegemony from these persons. So cultural habit, marriage, parental rights, individual liberty, freedom of speech, rights of ownership, thrift, timeliness, the entrepreneurial spirit. All of these are cultural norms. And they cannot be differentiated from one another on the basis of truth. They're differentiated from each other on the basis of hegemony. So this, eventually that development primarily rests on a writer named Theodor Adorno and the Frankfurt School, but I'm not going to dive into that. But essentially it does begin with this turn into cultural Marxism with Gramsci. What differentiates cultural norms is their origin in different classes, races, or other identity markers. And the one accepted as normal is accepted as normal not because it's true, but because it comes from a group with hegemony. And it's therefore packaged as a product of knowledge pre-verified by political power. So it's like now that you have hegemony and you basically set the standards, well, it's obvious that whatever's coming out from you, you'll easily meet those standards. No one else will. Because it's not actually truth-aimed, it's power-aimed, it's politically aimed. Wrapping this up here, just about done with this part. Gramsci will see this kind of hegemony to blind the lower classes, the proletariat, because he still sees it primarily from a Marxist perspective. Interestingly, though we can't go into postmodernism, one of the more significant postmodernists was a Frenchman named Michel Foucault, and he saw it the other way. He basically said, all of this stuff, this kind of hegemony, blinds the bourgeoisie, the upper classes, the well-to-do, the privileged. So that actually what happens essentially is these younger babes who would be growing up maybe with a more pure kind of view of the world, they are socialized into the patterns of the powerful, which make them arrive into their adulthood blind to it all, actually, so that they will freely participate in the perpetuation of this privilege pattern. So you've got, this is one reason why, because again, we're not just doing history of philosophy and sitting around and going, well, all of this is inconsistent. No, inconsistency is baked into the cake sometimes when you're dealing with ideas. This is why some people refer to woke or removing blindness, and sometimes it's from the oppressed, and sometimes it's from the oppressor. Right, and so they have different origins in the actual flow of the philosophy and the ideas, but eventually when they arrive prepackaged at our doorstep, it can go either way. People can refer to you as blinded or in need of waking, whether you are part of the privileged or the oppressed. So for these reasons here, current discussions from CRT and other critical theories easily use phrases about unconscious bias, being woke to signal like when you become conscious, and the idea of blindness for the marginalized or the privileged, whose blindness in their comfort is necessary to maintain the status quo. If you're not blind, comfort in that way, you wouldn't maintain the status quo. So that is how the story of Marxism both does and does not describe currently what's going on. These days, of course, people have loved to be petulant and childish and nasty in these conversations and simply say, you're a Marxist, and then say, no, you have any idea what Marxist is. And just go back and forth on these kinds of things. So generally speaking, as you can see from the history, many of these movements are Marxist. Yet, we are now quite a long ways removed from Marx. So technically, actually, they're neo-Marxist as the terminology. There is a long development at this point into moving from traditional economic Marxism through Soviet-style communism and so forth, and eventually to cultural Marxism, which we find in Gramsci and other thinkers. So it's kind of a yes and no situation. Well, questions or comments there? We're right on track, actually. That was right about an hour. We got back in here at about 35 after, and it's, 32 right now? 10:32? Yeah, 10:30. I think we might need a bit of a quicker break here, but, I mean, a longer break. Let's break until 10:40, and then we'll be back, and we'll do critical legal theory itself, critical race theory itself, and finish it up. So let's take a quick break.